pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate. You're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Here
we go. Well, I've pulled myself away from the partying over the events of the last week, and ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, I'd like to welcome back to the podcast Paul, who's joining us for a second night because the Iron Fist is still on holidays, taking a well-deserved break. And Paul, how's the week treated you?
The week's treated me much better than it's treated Tony Abbott, Scott. How about you?
Like I said, I've dragged myself away from the party. So.
Yeah, it's been quite a tumultuous week, hasn't it, for some more than others. But no, I've enjoyed it. It's been very interesting, very lively, and there've been a lot of interesting discussions.
Funnily enough, if you look at the media over the last week, you'd swear there was only one game in town. But of course, there are a few other things that did happen. Interestingly enough, in the last 24 hours, we've basically got a new ministry. So some of the people we'll be quoting tonight are no longer in the jobs that they were in when we were looking at the news late last week.
It does seem to overshadow all the other stories, but it is an important story. And I think it's right and proper that people take a significant interest in
the political life of our country. And to step back and sort of have a look at it and say, well, this was a significant event because... And, you know, at the end of the day, we can also, forces us to examine our system. I personally am not so worried about it being, what do they keep quoting? 4 prime ministers in 3 years or something?
Yeah, it doesn't trouble me too deeply, I have to say.
I mean, to my way of thinking, it's almost a strength in our system because if we do get a dud, which we've had a lot of in the last few years, we've had some bad ones, and we've got the opportunity to roll them rather than having to the poor old Yanks have to wait every 4 years if they
absolutely elected them. Look, I think it is a strength, and people seem to be looking at it far too negatively. I mean, we used to look askance at dictators because it was very hard to remove them from power, and surely if we can. We can have a crook leader and get rid of that crook leader with, you know, not too much effort and certainly no blood spilled.
Well, no violence.
That's got to be a good thing, surely.
I would have thought so.
Yeah. So let's count our blessings.
Blessings, for want of a term.
I hate using religious terms like that, but I couldn't think of anything better.
Well, we should be thankful for small mercies. We'll put it that way, shall we?
Okay, that sounds more secular.
But anyway, before we get started, obviously, we do have our disclaimer. While Paul and myself both met through the Secular Party of Australia, this does not mean that this is an official podcast of the Secular Party. It's a couple of guys having a chat about the week that was.
That's what it is.
And what we're kicking off with is from the Australian newspaper, Phonics, Faith and Coding for Primary School Kids. Mm. Paul, you're the teacher, so I'll hand it over to you. What do you reckon?
Well, I certainly am all in favour of improving the education system. I think there's a lot that needs to be improved. Phonics, sure, why not? Faith, well, I'm not sure that our children need more faith or more indoctrination of religious dogma. You know me well, Scott. You know that would be probably the last thing I would want kids to be learning about. I mean, I'm all in favour of learning about comparative religions as a part of their social studies curriculum. I'm absolutely in favour of that. I think kids should be taught comprehensively the history of our political life, our cultural life, where our societies came from, why we live in the societies we live in, for goodness sake. People need to understand our origins and how we got here in order to not only appreciate what we do have, and we are very fortunate in this country, but also to have a way of understanding how we can further improve things and continue to progress and go forward with our societies. But coding, this word coding worries me, Scott. What is that about? Phonics, faith, and coding. Oh, computer coding.
Computer coding. That's basically what it's about. Teaching computing languages. Course.
What do you think about that? Do our kids need to become computer coders at that tender age?
Well, I suppose it's going to become second nature to them, isn't it? In the same way that...
I don't know. Do we need to be coders to use the technology?
Well, to use the technology we've currently got, no. But to advance the technology, probably yes.
As software developers, as computer engineers, perhaps. But do we... How many of us need to be coders?
So you... Well, I mean, I suppose that's one question to ask. Are we starting them too early? Are we putting them on that, I don't know what the term is, but the road to a career too early rather than giving them a general education? Is that your concern?
Yeah, my concern is that kids need a general education, and how does that enhance their general education?
Well,
is it not a little bit too technical?
Potentially,
and mechanical in a sense. You know what I mean?
It's almost like you're teaching them to. It's almost like you're preparing them for a career as opposed to getting them through their education.
Yeah, I think children need to, you know, need things that help them to grow intellectually, emotionally, and socially. I'm not sure they need to acquire job skills at that tender age.
Well, yeah, and you are talking about a primary school curriculum here, so potentially it's a bit early. Me being the accountant, I didn't think it was such a bad idea to be looking at it anyway. I thought we're going to have to become become very literate in this. So as a species, we've got to get naturally, it's got to be part of our natural skill set. So I wasn't concerned.
We certainly have to be literate and numerate. The other thing that caught my mind was history and geography have been scrapped as standalone subjects. Now, my understanding, Scott, is that refers to the junior years of high school. And as a former teacher of these subjects, I'm not just sad, but I think it's a great loss to the general education of children, because I think history and geography... add something of great value to people's intellectual development.
Well, my lessons of history was not just learning what had happened from the past, but also seeing how different historical events evolved, I think is probably the term.
Yes, what shapes history?
Well, exactly, I mean, if you look at, I'll break Godwin's law, look at Nazi Germany, it evolved from... one of the most progressive nations in Central Europe.
Yes.
It had a very young democracy because they had a Kaiser prior to the Weimar Republic, but a nation that led the world in the emancipation of women and educating women and that sort of stuff ended up treating women like breeding factories. So understanding the societal tides that were present at the time, I think, teaches us a lot about how to avoid those problems in the future.
Yeah.
If we look at it properly.
I think it's also an abject lesson in the dangers of tribalism, because let's face it, it wasn't just the Germans, even our own country. I mean, the call to arms during the war was, partly a tribalistic response to what was a genuine danger for Australia, I think, in terms of the threat from the north. But look, things have been happening in Japan in relation to education recently too, and I saw an article where the Japanese government had decided they were not going to so generously fund the liberal arts subjects in their university courses, because in Japanese university degrees they actually spend the first 2 years. At least my understanding is that they spend the first 2 years doing general studies, liberal arts type subjects, in order to make them genuinely well-educated citizens. Then they specialise in their chosen field. Now, I don't think that's a bad thing at all. In fact, I'm quite in favour of it. But the Japanese government recently announced that they were going to stop funding to the same degree the liberal arts. In other words, they no longer see these humanities type subjects as necessary or even
desirable,
desirable,
which is rather
which is very sad. And the reason they gave, Scott, was they thought that because of Japan's somewhat dire economic situation of the last couple of decades, that people needed to be trained to work and to be productive rather than to be knowledgeable and well-rounded citizens. Now, that strikes me as a troubling development.
Absolutely, because let's face it, I mean, knowledgeable, educated citizens are then creative, educated citizens.
They're creative.
And creative people generate wealth. And
not only that, but they, I think they're more creative in a broader sense as being citizens and knowing, understanding how a democratic society is supposed to work and actually putting it into effect.
And look, you know, I mean, Japan has had their protests in recent weeks, but none of it broke down into smashing glass and that sort of stuff. They were probably the most respectful protests.
But I saw some scenes of scuffling inside Parliament building. Yeah.
In the Diet, isn't it?
Oh, they call it something else in Japanese. I think the Diet is...
it's the westernisation of
the
word.
I think it's an English word for what they call it, yeah. But yeah, it is interesting.
I mean, there are a few other points that are in there. There's... seems to be a fair concentration on things such as domestic violence and respectful relationships and so on and so forth. I suppose I don't know what the answer is to domestic violence. I mean, clearly as a nation, we cannot continue to lose one or two women a week to violent deaths. That's not... Not only is it morally reprehensible that it's happening, but two, it's a terrible waste of human life. And we have to do something. I don't know what the answer is, but I'm not entirely convinced that teaching primary school kids right from word go about domestic violence is the right way to go forward.
No, I suspect, Scott, that domestic violence is, you know, I don't know how to put it, but part of our human nature, or our male nature especially, is that males just seem to be predisposed to react with violence in certain circumstances.
Which is a real, real pity. It really is.
It is. But I, like you, I don't think we can necessarily just
educate
our way out of it. I think it's a very complex social and psychological issue that I think is going to be a much harder nut to crack than that.
Mm.
But having said that, I think if they do have relationships education and they teach people to be respectful of each other, I don't think that's a bad thing.
It's not going to hurt anyone, I would have
thought.
The one final point, all the teachers, you can hear them cheering in the background, can't you, where that talks about the... where are we?
Playing
they also properly. Endorsed historic reforms to teacher education prepared by the Australian Institute of Teaching and School Ownership. What the argument there is that we have to improve the quality of our teachers and also improve, make it a more attractive profession.
Yeah.
Now, yes, I'm an accountant, so I see a lot of things in dollars and cents. Surely we have to pay higher salaries to attract the better candidates. And that's only going to come about when we have a general change in attitude amongst the population to say that not only is education compulsory, it's also a worthwhile endeavour.
Yes.
And to get a good quality education, we maybe have to pay a little bit higher with salaries to our teachers.
Yeah.
But look, I mean, all in all, it was an interesting... this is probably Christopher Pyne's... Well, it is Christopher Pyne's last act as the Education Minister. He's off to Science and Innovation now in his portfolio responsibilities. Industry, Science and Innovation, I think, is the... Industry, Innovation and Science is his portfolio he's gone to now. But this was his swan song in education, so...
Yeah, look, I probably see this from maybe... too subjective a viewpoint as a teacher myself, but do you as I do suspect that people see teaching as a job, as a sort of partly teaching, partly babysitting type job? I think the whole profession needs to be made more professional, and in several aspects. I know one thing that appalled me when I was a teacher was I was told by, you know, a deputy or a head, principal, maybe not directly, but the message was given to us that we were teachers, we could be asked to teach literally any subject.
Mm.
We were told, hey, you are teachers, you will teach. Doesn't matter whether you have no training, no in-depth knowledge of the subject, you are teachers, you will teach, that's your job. Now, it struck me as absurd at the time, it still does. And I've met teachers from other countries, and I know countries like Germany and I think other European countries. Teachers train in the area of specialization in which they work, and that's the only teaching they do. They only teach the subjects that they understand at a deep level, that they have proficiency in, and they're never asked to teach something else. Now, I was once asked to teach mathematics. I barely got through what was ordinary level mathematics in the school certificate in New South Wales. Barely got through ordinary level, which was the lowest level at which you could actually pass mathematics.
Mm.
And I didn't do it at the senior level. Now, to then ask me to teach mathematics to kids, I was just shocked.
Yeah.
And I basically told them, I'm sorry, I cannot do this.
And, you know, an example like that is a screaming indictment of the system. The system needs to be fixed.
It's not completely broken, but there's a lot that needs to be fixed.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Moving abroad now to happier parts of the world, like the Middle East.
Not exactly happier.
Now, Paul, you and I don't think have ever had a discussion about what to do about Daesh or IS or Islamic State.
It's
or
a big question.
It's a very big question. Now, for a long time there, I think we all sort of thought that the lines on the map on the Middle East were just like lines on the map in Europe, and that, you know, you had certain areas were made up of this people and they were homogenous and so on and so forth. The only advantage, if I can call it that, to come out of the 2003 invasion of Iraq was that it actually educated us all to have a deeper, not perfect understanding, but a deeper understanding of the Middle East.
And how the lines were put there.
How the lines were put there, and just find out that behind the Iraqi lines, it's not homogenous. There are some very big divisions. Into that sectarian soup, our former Prime Minister has committed, well, with Cabinet's approval, has committed the RAAF to be involved in combat air missions over Syria. So like I said, Paul and I don't think we've ever had a discussion about this. Paul, what do you think? Should Australia be involved militarily in the Middle East in this fight, or should we be finding some other way to contribute? What's your view?
My view is that I don't think it's necessarily a bad idea to be involved, but what I'd like to see is a greater effort by the countries of that region to get involved.
Mm.
It seems to me it's a problem as much as for them as for anybody else in the global community, and they seem to be, look, with exceptions, Jordan, Lebanon and Turkey have taken huge numbers of refugees, and I don't think we can discount that contribution. But in military terms, there are some very wealthy states around Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states who appear very willing to just let the problem fester, let, you know, refugees flow out of that area into Europe and not bother them. They don't appear at all interested in taking refugees, and they don't seem very interested in getting involved militarily either, except for the Saudis are bombing
Yemen
quite hideously, and terrible reports are coming out of that country.
Now, what I'm hearing there is that Yemen is apparently a proxy, want of a better term, a cold war between Saudi Arabia and Iran for top dog status of the region.
Yes.
So,
because it has a sizable Shiite minority in Yemen.
Oh, okay. Is that right?
And they're getting support from Iran.
The Iranians would be backing the Shia majority.
That's right. Just as the Iranians back the Alawite tribe, if I can put it that way, of the Syrian president.
Okay.
So he's also a member of a minority sect.
Yeah.
who are not Sunni.
Mm.
In fact, they are more closely, apparently, and I don't understand in great detail, but their sect is closer to the Shiites than it is to the Sunni. Mm. So he's getting support from the Iranians too.
Mm.
So the Iranians are backing, you know, the Iraqi Shiites. They're backing the Shiites in, even in Saudi Arabia, there are Shiite minorities in the eastern part of Saudi Arabia, and they've been, there've been some trouble with them lately too.
And it, look, this is the main point that I took from what I had read over this last week. Well, I've been reading about it for several months because it's been in the news for several months, but it came into sharper focus for me once you start, well, we're flying military operations over a country that hasn't asked us to do anything.
Mm.
Now, ABC fact checked has said that no, our Air Force personnel will not be charged. It's not, you know, they said there's more to the story than just the simplistic view that was put out by, you know, ill-informed people like myself saying, well, we don't have their permission. Are we committing a war crime? It turns out we're not, but, you know, it's all open to interpretation. What also struck me, sorry, Paul.
No, I was just going to say, it seems to me this is a global problem.
Well, yeah.
Daesh is, it's confined to the Middle East, but it seems to me this, you know, this problem of, you know, a small motivated group of people acquiring modern weapons and then going on a rampage and actually taking control of territory. I think the whole world should be a little bit concerned about this.
Well, maybe, but having said that, though, if you've got a situation, and there's an ABC report, which is from, where are we? This is from the ABC site, European Migrant Crisis, Iraqi Soldiers Ditch Fight Against Islamic State for Life in Europe.
Mm.
When you actually read into that, listeners, it's pretty awful. If you've got soldiers abandoning their post, and they're blaming their government in Baghdad,
yeah,
then you've got problems. Now, if you've got a state big that problems is beginning to disintegrate.
Yeah, and it looks like it is.
It does look like it's disintegrating, but if you've also got young soldiers, so this bloke, one of the blokes here, Iraq is worth fighting for, but the government is not, said a 22-year-old policeman who's decided to emigrate after his brother was killed in battle. Now, if you've got a 22-year-old guy who has been trained how to use weapons, and he's abandoning his post because of the central government in Baghdad, it then begs the question, if Iraqi soldiers are abandoning their posts and leaving their weapons behind, why should American, British, Australians, Canadians, Germans, French, Englishmen, that sort of stuff, should be, why should they be risking their sons' lives in a war that the Iraqi people appear to have walked away from?
I think this could well be one of the defining issues of our time, Scott, is what we do about all this.
Well, short of recolonising and then carving it up on more tribal lines to try and overcome those problems, which I don't think is going to happen.
Nobody wants to recolonise.
No, not with that. It would be impossible to hold on to and all that sort of stuff. But
it would be ethically unjustifiable, and no Western democracy would ever get it their populations to agree with it and back it.
Absolutely. And here's the other problem too. Now, you've got Vladimir Putin from Russia, who is now involved in a tactical, well, he's probably there for strategic reasons.
Yes.
There are reports that there are Russian personnel around a Russian, I don't know if it was a Soviet era base, but certainly it was a Soviet era naval base, but they've also got an Air Force base in Syria. Now,
it's on the Mediterranean.
Exactly. So it's the only, is the term warm water port, is that what you call it?
I think so.
Yeah, but certainly the Mediterranean doesn't get icebound like the northern Russian ports.
Yes.
Yeah. The Russian northern ports, they do get icebound, so if you want free movement of Navy, then you probably want a Mediterranean port.
And it's a vital area of the world, obviously.
Yeah. Now, they are backing Assad, with the West does not seem to want to back Assad.
Mm.
And I've said before on this podcast that Assad was a prick, but at least he's a secular prick. The other point I'd make about Assad too is that he is from a minority group, just as Paul has just said. And if his dictatorship falls apart, you've got to question how safe the minorities in Syria are going to be, especially if Daesh takes control, because they've shown themselves not to be particularly magnanimous in victory.
quite the opposite.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, beheading an academic that had been looking after ancient ruins and so on and so forth, yeah. And burning Jordanian pilots to make a point, and beheading Western journalists. They've shown themselves not to be real nice people.
No.
And so hence, I suppose there's, when you see absolute blatant violations of human, of normal standards of human behaviour, it's understandable why Western governments do want to try and get involved militarily and end it.
Yeah.
But I do question whether or not there will be any success in the, well, certainly it doesn't look like there'll be success in the short term, but
no, it doesn't look
on in the longer term, you know, even a country like Turkey, they have a very different opinion of what, of Kurds than what the rest of us do in the Western world. And for example, just as this is just posted today on the ABC website, tens of thousands rallying against Kurdish terrorists in Turkey. And the speech that, now how do I pronounce the president's name, Paul? Is it Gerd?
The president of Turkey?
Yeah, president of Turkey.
Erdogan,
is it? Okay.
No, I think I've got it right. Erdogan.
Erdogan, yeah, Erdogan. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, if you listen to some of what he had actually said, where is that? Okay, this is one of the people who had been in, actually in the protest. We will support Erdogan to the end. We are behind him because he defends our flag and our nation.
Yeah.
That's just plain old nationalistic, jingoistic...
It really is.
...politics.
It really is, yes. It's tribalism.
Absolutely. And then when you come down to it, when the, you know, the Kurdistan Workers Party, which is the...
Another tribe.
That
lives in that part of the world.
Lives in that part of the world. It's the PKK, which I don't even... I wouldn't even know how to pronounce what the words behind PKK are, but that organisation has been listed by Australian authorities as being a terrorist organisation. Yeah. Now, hence again, I come back to my point. These guys in that region, whether they be Turks, Iraqis, Syrians, Iranians, Saudis, what have you, it's not... They don't seem to identify themselves along a national boundary. They seem to still identify themselves... by a tribal link, a religious link or something like that, rather than I'm not Iraqi, I'm a Shia.
Yeah.
Or I'm a Sunni.
That's right.
You know, and so that identity doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to a Western mind.
No, but interestingly, and academics have, I think, written about this and commented on this, is that in the post-Cold War world, identity politics has really come into its own. You know, rather than people identifying with a nation state, they're now identifying much more with their ethnic identity, whatever that may be. And it seems to me, and we've talked about this before, at least privately, that Muslims have a very strong sense of Muslim identity. It's a very major component of their personal identity, is that they are a member of this group of whatever it is, 1.5, 1.6 billion people on the planet identify as Muslims. And it's a very big part of their identity complex, if I can put it that way.
As human beings.
Yeah. So I think this identity politics is going to be a very major part of, the what goes on in the world in terms of conflict and a whole range of things, cultural...
Unfortunately, it appears that that whole identity conflict, for want of a better term, looks like it's starting to flare up and get hot. It's not staying like a Cold War conflict where you were either a capitalist or a Bolshevik, and provided, you know, you stayed on your side of the Danube or they stayed on their side of the 38th parallel, there was no problem.
Yeah.
But it seems to be these are crossing borders and becoming transnational conflicts. Mm,
they certainly are. Of course, the Kurds have, occupied for quite a few decades. They've occupied a space that wasn't ever really recognised by the international community, or at least the powers that be in the international community. And they were effectively drawn out of existence by the... Was it the French and the British?
Well, once they carved up the Ottoman Empire at the end of the First World War.
So they didn't take the Kurds into account, and they effectively wrote them out of the picture, didn't they?
Yeah,
and the
exactly.
Kurds have never accepted it, and they've been in conflict with various governments, Syrian, Iraqi, Turkish, and Iranian, ever since.
And at the end of the day, if we are talking about military success against Daesh, the only people that seem to be putting up a decent fight are the Kurds.
Are the Kurds, yes. They're highly committed.
Absolutely.
Much more so than the Iraqi soldiers we've been reading about.
It seems to me that the Kurds almost look like, well, we've got nothing to lose, we're going to fight it out. And hence I have reservations about military action. I'm not convinced it will actually work. And I'm also, when I hear reports about Iraqi soldiers abandoning their posts and heading for a nicer life in Europe, which is entirely understandable.
It's entirely understandable.
But
So what do you make of the humanitarian crisis that is unfolding before us, Scott?
Well, you know, I mean, I know Germany has put their hand up and said they're going to take 800,000 in a year. Well, they've got a population of 80 million or thereabouts in Germany. 800,000, that's what, 1% of the population they're going to take in 1 year. It's, yes, it is only 1%, listeners. However, that is 1% in 1 year.
That's a big ask.
Now we can hear it here on our news broadcast when you have Syrians and Iraqis speaking to the journalists in English. We haven't heard any of them speak in German. So that's the first hurdle. Probably of that 800,000, you've got to expect well north of 700,000 won't speak German.
And I am involved in language education, Scott, and I often ask students which are the more difficult languages to learn. And a lot of them say German is quite a difficult language. It's the grammar is quite complex and intricate. And, of course, they can learn, you know, street German, enough German to get a job as a construction labourer or as a factory worker.
Cleaner or something like that.
They wouldn't necessarily have to have the best quality German, but it's a difficult language, apparently.
Yeah, and look, that's even just the least of their concerns. Getting involved in a cultural setting where going to the pub, yes, you don't go and get drunk, but going having a stein with your co-workers, it's quite normal. Eating sausages that are mostly pork is quite normal. So for people who have grown up in a culture and or religion that does not consume pork and does not consume alcohol, those things are going to seem very, very weird.
Yes.
So I do think that I think it's entirely natural for the German government to respond the way they did when you are faced with, you know, waves of humanity that are willing to take the risk of drowning to get to Europe. It's entirely understandable on a human point of view why you would open your borders. However, opening the borders could well cause problems.
Yes.
But having said that, though, the Syrian civil war is what now, 4 years old or 5 years
old? Something like that. Yeah, it's
in its fourth or fifth year. It doesn't appear to be ending anytime soon. So I think people that have been living in Jordan and Lebanon have probably now had a gutful and thought, well, we're never going to go home.
Yeah.
So we're getting out now.
Yeah.
And hence why I think it's probably now coming to a head where people have realised that Assad's not going anywhere, the rebels aren't going anywhere. So it looks like it's descending into a long-term bloody civil war.
It looks like more and more like an abyss.
Yeah.
And who wouldn't want to leave? And look, you know, I agree with you. I think the Germans have, you know, at a certain level done exactly the right thing. And I think the Germans, I mean, I've never been to Germany, but most of the Germans I've ever met struck me as extremely civilized, nice people. Mm. And I think their response is a very noble humanitarian response. But of course, the other side of it is, where does it end? And they may well, you know, struggle, but succeed in accommodating, you know, 800,000 people in a year. And they may well do it. The Germans are resourceful
and enterprising people.
Enterprising and relatively wealthy as a nation, and they may well have the means to do it. But what if next year there's another 800,000 and the year after that another 800,000?
Well, there are 4 million Syrians living outside of Syria.
That's right.
Now, if you take 800,000, then in 5 years' time you will empty the refugee camps outside of Syria.
Yeah.
Now, you can't expect to accommodate 4 million people in Europe in a 5 year period.
But it goes beyond that, doesn't it? It's not just refugee camps in Syria. If people in the refugee camps in Africa, for goodness sake, and there are a lot of people in refugee camps in Africa, if they see on their news reports Syrians are literally walking and taking boats and taking trains and buses that in some cases have been provided for them into Europe to a better life, why wouldn't they want to do the same?
It's entirely understandable, but I'm not sure. I don't claim to be an expert in it, but I do wonder whether or not Germany might regret its show of compassion, I suppose.
I'm sure at least some Germans will regret it. I'll put it that way.
But look, I'm speaking entirely selfishly here. I'm very pleased we're not in that part of the world having to deal with it. It would be a horrible thing to actually watch.
Yeah, what sort of a light do you think it throws on Tony Abbott's strategy of stopping the boats in light of what's happened?
In light of what's happened
in Europe.
Yeah, but did we really think that people were going to be coming all this way from Syria when it was an easier journey into the Mediterranean?
No, obviously Europe is a lot closer and a lot more accessible.
I mean, look, I honestly thought that Gillard had the genesis of a good idea when she was talking to Malaysia about an international solution where you had member states that would then say, well, if you arrive in this region, you'll be processed in this region and you'll be resettled in A, B or C.
Yeah.
A's taking 50% of you, B's taking 25% of you, C and D are taking 5% and so on and so forth. So then you took the, want of a better term, the sugar pot of Australia off the table, and you said, well, you've only got a 50-50 chance of making it to Australia. Yeah. So I thought that was the genesis of a good idea. Yeah. It didn't come to fruition. No, but, a lot of what Tony Abbott was going on with, though, was designed for the domestic market more so than the international market.
Look, I think it partly was, and I'm not a fan of Tony Abbott, but I can see at some level the logic in doing whatever it took to stop that flow of people across the sea. And look, I'm as appalled as anyone, I think, by the treatment of people in those camps on Manus Island and Nauru. They really are festering sores on the Australian, psyche. And they need to be addressed.
Absolutely.
But at the same time,
I don't think we should have opened them again. I thought the facilities should have been on Australian soil.
Yeah.
I don't understand why it was this imperative to open them.
I think the logic was they were trying to send a message. If you try to come to Australia by sea, you will not be in Australia. You will be taken out of Australia. Therefore, you will not have succeeded.
Yeah.
And to take away that idea that, gee, once we're in Australia, even if we're in detention, once we're in Australia, we're halfway there. So they wanted to take away that whole psychological scenario of people feeling like they'd made it.
Yeah, they might have done, but where that logic has to lead is that eventually you have to make life so insufferably bad as a refugee in Australia that it's even worse than explosives falling from the sky on top of it.
Which is hard to do.
It's, well, what it means is you've got to make yourself really nasty.
Yes. And they did that.
They did do that. Yeah, yes. They did do that.
And Scott Morrison, a professed Christian of the Pentecostal variety, has shown himself to be a right bastard when it comes to treating people harshly in order to discourage them from coming to Australia.
And it does, to me, the question I've never had answered by of this policy, I said, well, just how cruel to be kind do we need to be? And considering what happened on Manus Island in my name when a young bloke, 20-something from Iran, he died for a simple lack of antibiotics. If they'd got him to decent levels of antibiotics quicker, an infected foot shouldn't kill you. But he ended up with blood poisoning and all the rest of it, and that was done.
It is in the tropics, of course, and things like that happen a lot quicker than they do in a cool climate.
Which is why they needed to get into a hospital, not be dispensed aspirin at a medical centre of a concentration camp.
Look, I can't justify at any level the level of brutality and mistreatment of people that is reportedly taking place.
And I think part of the reason that they were able to get away with it for so long is because it was offshore, out of sight, out of mind.
Yes.
Whereas I think that if the facilities were on Australian soil, then the media would be more likely to see what was happening.
That's right.
They would have access to the courts if anything went terribly wrong. Mm-hmm. But where they are now, they're in legal limbo.
Yes, it's a sad situation.
Absolutely. But look, you know, at the end of the day, even though Howard was pilloried for saying it at the time in 2001, we will decide who comes to this country in the manner in which they come.
Yeah.
I don't think it's unreasonable for a nation to be able to have control over their borders.
No.
But you don't need to be too cruel to be kind.
It's a tough nut.
It is a tough nut.
I don't know how it's going to be cracked.
But considering you've already got, if you add the displaced people inside Syria to that 4 million number, you've then got 11 or 12 million in total.
Yeah. And look, you know, don't forget there are still, I believe, at least several hundred thousand Afghanis in Pakistan still now, living in various places. I don't know if they're in camps or just blended with the local urban areas.
It's such a porous border, you wouldn't really know who's an Afghan and who's a Pakistani person, you know.
Well, I wouldn't know, but... Yeah.
Maybe the local authorities do, but certainly...
But what I've read, reports from Afghan refugees in Pakistan, they don't have a good life there.
No.
And they would like to leave, obviously, for a better place like Australia or Europe. And why wouldn't they? You know, I mean, we can't blame people for wanting to have safety, for wanting to have food security, for wanting to have education and opportunities for their children.
Well, it's only natural that you want your children to achieve more than what you have achieved.
Yeah.
And if your memory of a childhood in Afghanistan was interrupted by a Soviet invasion, then a brutal theocratic dictatorship,
yes,
you're going to want to try and get out. And so that if you've got children on your hip, you're going to want to definitely get out, because you want your children to have a better life than what you did.
You want your children to be safe.
Yeah.
Above all.
Above all else, it's fun. You want them, fundamentally, you want your children to be safe.
Yeah.
Then, of course, our old favourites, the Catholic Church.
The Catholic Church. How could we not say something about the Catholic Church?
This is an article from the Global Post, which was posted by the Secular Party on their Facebook page. U.S. priests accused of sex abuse get a second chance by relocating to South America.
But this is a Catholic Church tradition.
Well... Did you know what John Oliver, the guy from, what he said about the Catholic Church?
No, what did he say about the Catholic Church?
He was talking about the Pope anyway. When the Pope had made some public announcement, Oliver turned around and he says, yes, he says, well, you know, when you're the head of an international pedophile ring, that, which is harsh, possibly fair.
He's a funny man.
He is a funny man, but anyway.
Yeah, look, I don't necessarily see the Catholic Church as just, a bunch of pedophiles. But,
no.
But clearly they... their institutional structure has provided a safe haven for pedophiles.
And look, the most kind thing I can say about this is that clearly they don't know how to react. They don't know how to deal with the problem. I mean, grabbing people out of the United States and then dropping them, where are they? In Paraguay, Ecuador, Colombia, Brazil and Peru. I mean, what did they think? Just say, we'll send them down the third world.
Those dumb Latins won't know what we're sending them.
I mean, like, that's just terrible. But, the Pope, Francis, to his credit, where is he?
Oh, he's come out quite
publicly. He's very strong and said that, there's got to be a zero... Is that the American one? Yeah, the zero tolerance policy. In which priests who molest children are no longer allowed a second chance to serve in the clergy. Yes. Well, good on him for saying it.
Absolutely.
But how long has it taken for the global church to get to that point of view?
And will his, his dictates actually filter down to the grassroots level for the priests?
Well, are the priests and the bishops going to take the advice, or take the instruction?
Yes. Because it's a very big organisation, and to assume that everybody will just jump to the Pope's bidding is a big assumption.
Well, not only is it an assumption, it's if history is anything to go by, they don't necessarily take instructions from head office.
No, they don't. And the Catholic Church, for a long time, has had a number of different traditions operating within a tradition, hasn't it? And there's been a very strong intellectual tradition in the Catholic Church too. And if, even coming from me, you know, a person who doesn't have much time for religious dogma, and the Catholic Church produces its fair share, but they also have produced, you know, an academic tradition of scholars among them.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Right. Okay. So particular orders, or?
I think so, although I couldn't tell you what they were, Scott. Yeah. I did a bit of research into something I did at university for a dissertation. So I read a lot about... Well, I actually read publications and papers written by what were essentially Catholic priests, but they were scholar priests, if you like.
Mm, interesting.
Yeah.
Of course, back to that part of the world, you know, the Middle East. We're back in Egypt now. This was also from the Secular Party Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
He's a young man. He is only, I thought they gave us his age somewhere or other. Yes. He's a university student.
In his early 20s.
There he is, now 22.
Yeah.
He was in a sociology lecture, and the professor of sociology was leading a discussion of some description.
Mm-hmm.
This young man questioned his sociology professor. Gave a thought they should approach topics from a scientific point of view, not a religious point of view.
Yes.
And suddenly his place got raided by the Jacks at 3 a.m.
Indeed.
He was hauled before the courts and earlier this year sentenced to 1 year hard labour.
Yes. And all for questioning his sociology professor.
Exactly. Now, I mean, hell, I questioned professors all the time when I was at uni and I never got banged up for it.
My recollection is we were encouraged to question them.
Yeah.
And that if we saw things differently, we were encouraged to, you know, explore it.
Mm.
But also to make some sort of intellectual justification if we disagreed.
And you couldn't just say, your answer couldn't be just because.
And it couldn't be just, you are wrong.
Exactly. You had to say why you thought something, yes, what you thought you were going to get out of it, and so on and so forth.
And this young man seems to have embraced, you know, learning in the Western Enlightenment tradition.
Of questioning, yeah.
Yes.
But, like I said, the Jacks arrived at 3 a.m. He was arrested. I don't know if he was arrested at that particular day, but the...
Charged with crimes ranging from contempt for religion. That's a crime in Egypt, apparently, and you know, it probably is in other countries where Islam, and we, you know, there's no getting away from it. Islam is the dominant religion
in Egypt, yes.
And it seems to come from Islam, this idea that Islam, that, you know, the theology cannot be questioned, that it has reached the end point, and that it's beyond criticism.
Well, you know, in fairness, I mean, the church. The Christians, when they were running theocracies...
Oh, they had a similar attitude, yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, the Inquisition and all the rest of it came about absolutely because people were questioning the religion.
Yes. But that still...
In the modern terms...
That still doesn't take us away from the fact that, you know...
This is an Islamic example of oppression from a theocracy.
It is.
Even though Egypt was supposed to be liberated.
Well, it's not a theocracy in Egypt, as we know, but it shows to the extent to which... religious theology has permeated thinking throughout the society.
And through to the law enforcement. So listeners, if you ever think people like myself, Paul and Trevor, bang on too much about secularism and why it's important to have a separation of church and government, just have a look at what happens when the two combine. It's not pretty.
Yes, and where religious authorities have too much power, or they have the power to decide what is truth and what isn't truth.
Yeah. And to then enforce that truth via the cops.
Yeah, and imprisonment.
Yeah. And even worse in some parts of the world.
In some parts of the world, much worse. Executions. Yes. And in Saudi Arabia, there was a report several weeks back that atheism had been put in the same basket with terrorism.
Yeah. And that the Saudi authorities were now employing further swordsmen to conduct a higher rate of...
Yes, there was an employment drive.
Employment drive to get more swordsmen to carry out the beheadings. Yeah.
Basically, yeah.
And yet they've just got presidency of the Human Rights Commission, or whatever it's called in the UN.
Yeah,
Paul, there's no getting away from it. There was a significant event last Monday evening.
There was a very significant event, and I think we quite enjoyed it, didn't we?
Yes, we did have the news on in the background. With it was muted, listeners. We were actually watching what was unfolding, and certainly our Prime Minister got rolled.
He did, indeed.
He has been replaced by the, for want of a better term, the People's Prime Minister, because poll after poll had shown that the former Communications Minister was the preferred leader of the Liberal Party and therefore the preferred Prime Minister. Malcolm Turnbull, in a coup d'etat,
if you want to put it
that dramatically, it was a very well orked.
Wasn't it beautifully executed?
Absolutely. It was very well done. They kept it very quiet.
I think I received a text message from you, Scott, late in the afternoon,
about 4 o'clock,
informing me that it was on, and before the night was out, it was over.
Yeah.
I mean, how fast and clean was that?
It was very quick. And clearly, look, ladies and gentlemen, Turnbull's not an idiot. He has learnt from his mistakes in 2009. He also learnt that there's no point launching a leadership challenge unless you've got the numbers.
Unless you're going to win.
Exactly. And what I had seen that evening, I was listening to the radio on the way home from the office. They were reporting that the Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, had been to see the Prime Minister earlier that afternoon and advised him that he no longer had the support of the party room. Once I'd heard that report, I thought, well, she's not an idiot either. She's not going to stick her head above the parapet if she didn't think she'd
She voted for Turnbull.
That's led over the last week, of course, to analysis after analysis after analysis. At the end of the day, I came down, I think the favourite bit of analysis that I saw was during yesterday's Insiders. Nikki Saver, who is a former staffer to former Federal Treasurer Peter Costello, she said, and I'm not quoting her exactly, but the crux of it was, if Abbott had done a good job, this wouldn't have happened.
Yes.
And that's really what it comes down to, is that Turnbull put it very beautifully. He did not make the same mistake that Ms. Gillard did, where she did not properly line up why Kevin Rudd had to be replaced. Mm. Turnbull left it in no doubt that, let's face it, our former PM appeared to be incompetent.
Yes. He was very honest in that sense.
Brutally so.
Brutally honest.
Yeah. But, there was no getting away from it, because even though, yes, okay, Rudd was rolled in his first term, it's not a usual thing to do I'm not going to use the word knife because that's been overused, but it's not a usual thing to remove a first-term Prime Minister. Mm. As a general rule of thumb, the nice thing to do, the polite thing to do, is to allow a Prime Minister to face the judgment of the people, especially in Rudd and Abbott's case. They were both significant victories.
Yes.
And so under normal circumstances, you would agree that they should face the judgment of the people. However, Turnbull said, there are 30 news polls in a row that we are behind the opposition. Turnbull was right. They were staring down the barrel of what was looking more and more certain like an election defeat at some point in the future.
And virtually every Liberal Party commentator has said as much. They've all said it looked like almost certain defeat at the next federal election. And, we saw, and we were talking about this early, how Peter Costello came out and said, look, the only thing that counts is success.
Yeah, and Costello said axing Tony Abbott was most certainly the right thing to do.
Yes.
It's just appeared that it was all too...
It looked brutal and messy, but it was very clean and clinical.
It was clinical. And look, it came, and I can't remember Howard's exact words, but when he was asked about it, I think he said something like the relentlessness of arithmetic. I forget what his words were, but I remember thinking, wow, that's a good way of putting it. Mm. The numbers weren't lying. It was clear.
It's an interesting turn of phrase.
Yeah. I'm not sure that's exactly what
it was. I like it.
And in politics, they will all tell you that there's only one poll that matters. And the only politician you can believe saying that is someone from the secular party, because we can't afford to do our own polling. So we do rely on the election day poll. But
politicians, let's face it, on occasion, they say things that are totally self-serving and quite detached from
reality.
What they really think. Because I don't think any of them think that the polls don't matter and that the only poll that counts is the election.
They live and die by them. I mean, like,
of course they do.
Graham Richardson, within 5 minutes of leaving politics, became a commentator initially for the Nine Network. And he said, right from word go, he says, you live and die by the polls.
Yes. And this lie that they frequently peddle out about the Prime Minister is elected by the voters and can only be fired by the voters is complete nonsense.
It is nonsense.
None of them believe it.
No.
But when it suits them, they say things like that.
And also, at the end of the day, ladies and gentlemen, you know, that was Abbott's main line. He said, you know, you don't replace a first-time Prime Minister. Paul, if that's all you've got nothing.
Nothing, no.
No, you know, no. He deserved to go. I mean, if we take a look at the last 6 months, and I'm aware of the time, so I will try and keep it quick, but if we take just the last 6 months, for example, and again, this is Graham Richardson said it, he said he's the only Prime Minister that he can remember who had a bad Australia Day when he knighted Prince Philip. After that, we then had a, you know, he then had a near, what's been called by the papers, a near-death experience with the party room.
Yeah.
Where, incidentally, ladies and gentlemen, out of 100 people in that party room, 39 voted for an empty chair.
Yes.
There was no declared contender, but they were basically saying anyone but Abbott. Then after that, he said, I asked for 6 months. He got 7 months. The polls have only got worse. He left Bronwyn Bishop in the speaker's chair for a full 18 days.
Yes.
Now, that was a great big gangrenous wound that needed to be lanced immediately, but he let it go. It festered. It got out of control.
With gangrenous wounds, you have to amputate.
Well, amputate, too. Yes. Fair enough. Whatever it is. It was... It needed to be knifed to get the rubbish out.
Yes.
He left it for 18 days. It festered and festered and festered. And
it just got worse.
It did get worse. Yeah. And frankly, I don't think he actually fully understood the damage that backing Bishop did.
Yes.
They had a budget that got swept off the front pages because of Bishop. They had Bill Shorten taken before the Union Royal Commission, and that was swept off the front pages because of Bishop.
That's right.
All of these things, and then the final straw on the straw that broke the camel's back, in my view, was, and yes, I'm the first to declare I've got a vested interest in this, was when he bust in Rentatory from the National Party to sink the conscience vote on same-sex marriage. Mm. He showed utter contempt for his own people.
Yeah.
It's no wonder they abandoned him in droves.
Yeah. Some commentators say that basically because he wasn't pushing his political agenda successfully, he created a vacuum into which all these relatively trivial issues, like the knighthood, Bishop, they were able to occupy the vacuum. You know, they were able to occupy the public's consciousness to a far greater extent than they would have if he'd been successfully prosecuting his political agenda.
And he wasn't successfully prosecuting that political agenda because he was constantly saying, you know, the death cult's coming to get us.
Yes.
He then tried to justify the most extraordinary intervention into our own personal lives.
Yes.
On security issues.
Border force.
Oh, border force.
On the streets of Melbourne.
Melbourne, you know, checking people's papers.
Yeah, when was the border shifted to Melbourne?
Yeah. So, look, you know, when you add up all those things, individually, they wouldn't have sunk a government. But as Paul has beautifully put it, if you have a vacuum, that's the fundamental law of physics, nature abhors a vacuum. If you've got a vacuum, it's going to get filled.
Yes.
And it's going to get filled, in this case, with relatively trivial matters.
Yes.
And, you know, if he had been delivering excellent work, people would have sort of sworn and carried on about Bronwyn Bishop, but it probably would have been swept off the front page within 24 hours. But instead, as you said, there was nothing else there. That's why it filled up for
look,
so
we are running out of time, but it makes me wonder what would have happened if Kevin Rudd had been given 6 months to lift his game rather than be deposed by Gillard.
Straight away, you know.
What do you think?
Well, who knows? I mean,
the mind boggles.
It's one of those things that you just wouldn't know, you know.
Yeah.
But look, you know, over the last few days anyway, we've had nothing but speculation about what's going to happen to poor old Joe Hockey. Well, it's been answered. He said that he wouldn't be. He had said to Prime Minister Turnbull, privately that he wasn't going to seek a position on the front bench. Then
and the, that's probably the smartest thing Joe's done in a long time.
Oh, absolutely.
Because
he wasn't cutting
through.
He's
not a good performer, is he? He hasn't been a good performer at all.
But according to Senator Xenophon, he must be the chief Canberra gossip man these days, indeed. I think. But according to him,
Joe's going over.
Joe's going to become Kim Beazley's replacement as a diplomat to the United States.
You I don't think he's up to it, frankly. I really
well,
actually,
don't. No, someone else said it. Here it is. This is from Nick Xenophon. I said, I can think of many people who would be much worse than Joe. I think Joe, if he was going to take up a diplomatic position, would actually do Australia proud. Big praise, but anyway, we'll see.
Big praise.
But, you know, we will. And I have listeners, I have learned how to actually put links onto the website, so there will be links to these stories this time round. So there is the full, one of the things the ABC's done is they've done a graphic with people's faces and names, and then you put click a button underneath it to say what their new responsibilities are. If you look at this, the losers in the reshuffle obviously is Abbott and Hockey, Eric Abetz, Kevin Andrews, Ian McFarlane. The one that did surprise me was Bruce Bilson. I know we did talk about it briefly before we started recording, but he was the small business minister.
Yes. I'm not aware of his work, to be honest.
Well, I didn't know what he'd done wrong, to be honest. And Scott Ryan, I'd never heard anything of him, but he's now the assistant cabinet secretary, and that's the largest Bible I've ever seen. It's the Bible he took to be sworn in as an assistant cabinet secretary. Well, unfortunately, the tyranny of the clock has counted down. Yeah. Paul, final observations?
Final observations, Scott. It's been an exciting week in politics, and I look forward to many more.
Well, let's just hope that good luck. Congratulations and good luck to Prime Minister Turnbull. I
wish you'll all the best.
I do wish you all the best. I hope you do last longer than 2 years. My final observation, Paul, I think Malcolm's actually got the potential to be a longer-term Prime Minister. Let's just
with
hope...
With the right policies and policies. The right people serving in the ministries.
Yeah. I think he's got the potential to be there for quite some time. Let's just hope he's learned a few things, because that Godwin-Gretsch disaster in 2009 was an absolute mess, and that had his fingerprints on it, no one else's.
It was a bad mistake on his part.
So if he's learned from his mistakes and foul-ups back then as Leader of the Opposition, I think we could well have a long-term Prime Minister coming up for us.
It's possible. And it'll be interesting to see what happens on the other side of the House.
Well, yeah, they are sort of hogtied now, because it's almost impossible.
Very difficult position.
Yeah, I don't know if they can start a leadership spill. Well, I don't know what the mechanics of it are. My better half is a member of the ALP.
It can't happen overnight anymore.
No. Well, that's it. Yeah, it can't just end. What did Abbott call it when he was Leader of the Opposition? Midnight knock and political execution the next morning. That no longer happens on the Labor side.
The ALP,
so,
no.
But Paul, again, as always, fascinating conversation. Thank you
very much
for being with us.
Thanks for the invitation.
No problem at all. And listeners, we look forward to talking to you again next week.
Indeed.
All the best.
Have a great week.
Bye for now. Cheers.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone and just put the word out. The other thing is, you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee, Is it worth more than that, less than that, whatever you get out of it? Because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It just, it'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation, so you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners, and that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.